The Graham Greene International Festival cannot be suppressed. Mike Hill has volunteered to give us a talk on Graham Greene and the Nobel Prize. Now, Mike, as you will know, is the six-time director of the festival. He's the editor of a sort of newsletter, and he is the author with John Wise of the absolutely essential three-volume bibliography of Graham Greene. And we're thrilled and thankful that he is going to give us a talk today.
Thanks very much, Richard. That's very kind. Can you all hear me? Oh, sorry about that. Just to say before I begin that I'm a sort of serial GG Fest groupie, really. I've been to all of them since 1998 and, you know, enjoy all of them, and I keep coming back. I can't get enough of it, etc. But I've just been struck yesterday and today, and you know, back into Thursday evening indeed, not just at the quality of the people we've had here this year, but the fantastic range and variety of what's been on offer. If you've been to all the sessions, it's fantastic. I think Richard's done an absolutely superb job in putting so much good stuff in front of us. Now, I'm here, of course, to put that quality to an end, but or at least add my tiny grain of sand to the variety by saying a little bit about Graham Greene and the Nobel Prize. And I want to start with a bit of a challenge to you. And my quiz question for today is, how many people in the room can tell me who this woman is? Two people. Any more bids? Any more bids? Two people. Okay. Would one of those two people like to shout it out? Thank you. It's Annie Ernaux. Well done, you've won a prize, which is completely fictional. Yeah, this is Annie Ernaux, a French writer and winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2022. Her literary work is mostly autobiographical, I find by looking her up online. And her Nobel citation in winning the prize last year praised, quote, the courage and clinical acuity with which she uncovers the roots, estrangements, and collective restraints of personal memory. That's the citation. And last year, in winning the prize, she joined a tradition which goes back now for well over a century. Because on Thursday next, the 5th of October, by tradition at the stroke of 1 p.m. Swedish local time, the permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy, a chap called Mats Malm, will emerge through the doors of the Academy's offices in the old Stock Exchange building in Stockholm to announce to the waiting media the winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Literature. That's 1 o'clock next Thursday afternoon. The winner who gets announced then will get a medal, a diploma, and a prize currently worth, and I hope I've got this right, because it sounds as an astonishing amount of money, but I thought this is what the website told me, 11 million Swedish krona currently, which by my reckoning is around £880,000 or something over $1 million. Quite a substantial prize. The winner next week, he or she, will join the ranks of 119 literature laureates There have been 102 of them male and 17 female who have won the prize since it started in 1901. They'll join the winners in the other Nobel categories at a grand dinner and ceremony in Stockholm's City Hall on the 10th of December, an event that apparently gets televised on Swedish television. And all that follows the will of this man, Alfred Nobel, the Swedish inventor, entrepreneur, scientist, businessman, inventor of dynamite, who also apparently wrote poetry and drama. One name that's not on that list of 119 former winners is, of course, Graham Greene. Greene appeared often to be the blushing bridesmaid, but never the blushing bride. Year on year, apparently on the brink of winning it, until it became clear that that just was not going to happen. From the 1960s to the 1980s, journalists and critics joined in an annual chorus of, "Why not Greene?" Sometimes accompanied by a declaration that that year's winner was at best second rate in comparison. So why was this? If Graham Greene was such a credible candidate in the view of lots of people, why was he so consistently passed over? To investigate that question, we need to start with a bit of background about the process whereby the Nobel Prize in Literature is actually decided. The task of finding a winner each year falls to the Swedish Academy, these people, the highest Swedish language authority. It consists of a group of secretly elected, 18 secretly elected people based in Stockholm, writers, linguists, literary scholars, historians, and I understand a prominent jurist. The Academy had for a long time the reputation of being a heavily male-dominated institution. The current balance is 11 men and 7 women, and their average age at the moment is 66. The Academy devolves the detailed work on the prize to a 6-person Nobel Committee for Literature, currently made up of 4 men and 2 women. At the moment, there's a chairman, a chap called Anders Olsson, a writer and literary critic, plus 4 other writers and academics, plus the permanent secretary of the whole Academy, the previously mentioned Mats Malm, who is a translator, a literary historian, and an editor. Nominations for the 2023 Literature Prize will have been sent out last September by Mats Malm, asking people to nominate. And the range of eligible nominators around the world includes the Swedish Academy itself and similar organisations abroad, professors of literature and linguistics, presidents of societies of authors, and previous Nobel laureates. They get to nominate. The deadline for receiving those nominations was 31st of January this year for this year's prize. And by April, this is their diagram of how this whole process works. By April, the Nobel Committee will have got the nominees list down to about 15 or 20 preliminary candidates, and by May to a final shortlist of 5 normally. And in its work, that 6-person committee will commission expert appraisals of some of the candidates and, if need be, get translations of some of the works involved. The next 3 months are then spent in the 18, the whole Academy, members reading the works of the five shortlisted candidates. Usually the Nobel Committee will give a recommendation to the whole Academy as to who it thinks is a worthy winner. Sometimes it does that unanimously, sometimes by a majority. Sometimes there's not even a majority view, apparently. In September, the Academy then confers on who should win, and it may or may not agree with the recommendation, if there has been one, from the committee. And then next week comes the announcement in Stockholm. So how does the outline of these procedures help us understand what happened to Graham Greene? Our information on how decisions were made year by year comes in two forms. First, there are the Nobel papers relating to each year, the list of nominees and who nominated them, the expert appraisals where appropriate, the written views of the committee and of Academy members on the candidates. But these papers are kept confidential for 50 years. So we're currently in possession of papers up to and including 1972 only. And the papers relating to 1973 will not be released until January 2024 and so on through the years. Since we now know that Graham Greene was first nominated for the Nobel Prize in 1950, which I'll return to, there are currently, therefore, publicly available papers for the period relevant to Greene from 1950, his first nomination, through to 1972, but not beyond. And it must be added that, as far as I know, no British researcher, and certainly not myself, has systematically gone through the original papers in Swedish in Stockholm. Instead, what we have is we end up with a debt to the journalists of, in particular, the Stockholm newspaper, the Svenska Dagbladet. I should apologise for my Swedish pronunciation. There's more of that to come. Sorry. The newspaper is Svenska Dagbladet, I think, who each January comb through the recently released papers and write articles about the secrets they contain. On occasion, where there's been controversy, or perhaps where a British or American writer was involved, something may appear in the UK or US media. But even here, there's a caveat to make. What gets disclosed after 50 years are the written records of the committee and the Academy. The oral discussions, the compromises, the horse trading, the rows, where appropriate, are not on public view, except, of course, insofar as that might be evident from the written records that we find out about 50 years later. Fortunately, there is a second source of information about the decisions that were made. The members of the committee and Academy themselves. These people are by tradition meant to keep secret details of the committee, Academy, nominees, nominators, investigations and opinions. But in practice, they don't always keep to that tradition. In some cases, as we'll see, members of the Academy have gone public, and even members of the committee have gone public, or supplied rumours about what went on behind the scenes. And that, in turn, has allowed journalists to speculate on what the dynamics of decision-making have actually been. And that sometimes allows us a glimpse into the decisions made about Graham Greene, as we'll see. So on to Greene himself. Because the Nobel papers give us information about nominations for the prize each year, we can see how Greene fared over the years up to 1972. He was first nominated in 1950, and he was nominated, as you'll see from my little chart, in 17 of the 23 years between 1950 and 1972. 17 of the 23 years, a strong track record of a writer to be seriously considered by the Academy. In many years, as you'll see, he was nominated more than once. Perfectly possible that that should happen. And in total, if you add that list up, he was nominated over that 23-year period 28 times. All but one of the nominations was a male person, and all but one was based in Europe. And the one exception in both cases to those categories was Mary Renault, the English-born novelist who was then living in South Africa, who nominated Green in 1970 and 71 and 1972. The German writer Heinrich Boll also nominated Green in 1972, by coincidence, the year in which Boll himself actually won the prize. And just to give you a flavour of what these nomination papers look like, this is one page from 1972 of the secretary of the committee's typed up summary of all the nominees for 1972. And I've given you the page which includes Graham Greene. You'll see there are all sorts of things you might want to work out from that list. It's only part of, I think, a five-page list for that year, for 1972. Just to explain a couple of things, the people with an X against the name down the left-hand column are the people who are nominated for the prize for the first time, just to draw the attention of Academy members to that fact. And just to draw your attention to another thing, apart from Green on that list, on that page, I make it that there are four other future winners of the prize in literature. And I'll try and pick them out if you can hear me. Odysseus Elitis, number 25, won it eventually. William Golding, number 30, won it eventually. Nadine Gordimer, 31, won it eventually. And Gunter Grass, number 33, won it eventually, four of those. So we're talking about a pretty heavyweight field in 72. And just one other thing to ask your eye to land on that. There's a chap who nominated two of those future winners who's mentioned there, Herr Lundqvist. We are going to come back to Herr Lundqvist. But back to Green and his range of nominations between 1950 and 1972. Nine of those 28 nominations were from professors. The record in that regard being held by a chap called Christian Schmidt, who was a professor of English literature at the University of Oslo, who nominated Green in six different years. And four of Green's nominators were members of the Swedish Academy itself, the people who would end up awarding the prize. In those years, Green was up against scores of other nominees, of course. The lowest number of writers over this period nominated was 24 in 1953, and the highest was 103 in 1989. So how does Green's record of being nominated 28 times compare with others who appear on these lists? Well, of those like Green who never won, so trying to compare like with like, I reckon that the strongest contenders of non-winners were André Malraux, the French writer, with no fewer than 75 nominations, Robert Frost with 31, W.H. Auden with 29, and Jorge Luis Borges, like Green, on 28. And of those who actually won the prize during that period, or won the prize at some point, who were nominated during the period 50 to 73, if you're still with me, I calculate that between 50 and 73, a winner required an average of 12 nominations before getting the prize. 12 nominations is the average over that period. Considerably lower, of course, than Green's tally, but I should point out, of course, nominations are not votes simply to be totted up and there you are, you've won the prize. So to look at how the Nobel Committee actually makes its decisions and how Graham Greene fitted into their deliberations, I thought I'd examine five of the years when Greene was a contender. 1950, 1961, 1967, 1974, and 1983. I'll start with 1950 because, as I say, that's the first year Greene was nominated. And in that year, he got two nominations, both of them from members of the Swedish Academy itself. At that stage in his career, he was aged 46, quite young by prize standards, it has to be said. And he'd published 12 novels, I make it, volumes of short stories, two travel books, as well as other writings, including a volume of poetry and film screenplays. His main claim to the attention of the Swedish Academy in 1950 were his three heavyweight novels, I guess we'd have to call them, Brighton Rock, The Power and the Glory, and The Heart of the Matter. And it was perhaps the latter's publication in 1948 which prompted his first nominations in 1950. In that 1950 list, he was up against a total of 53 other writers who had attracted a total of 77 nominations. That list included the Swedish writer Per Lagerkvist, who'd recently published his novel Barabbas, and who had 9 nominations, and Winston Churchill with 6 nominations. Lagerkvist went on to win the prize in 1951 and Churchill won it in 1953. As it happened, the Nobel Prize in Literature had not been awarded in 1949, so the Swedish Academy had 2 prizes to give out in 1950. The final shortlist of 5 for that year, we now know from the released Nobel papers, consisted of William Faulkner, Bertrand Russell, Ernest Hemingway, Graham Greene, and a joint nomination of 2 Greek writers, Angelos Sekelianos and Nikos Kazantzakis. Sorry about my pronunciation, that's Greek. So Greene made the shortlist at the first attempt, a promising start for his prospects of one day winning the prize. But of course, he didn't win in 1950. The prize for 1949 was retrospectively given to William Faulkner, which perhaps made it less like another American writer, Ernest Hemingway was on the shortlist, would be chosen for 1950. So for 1950, the prize went to the British mathematician and philosopher Bertrand Russell. Remarkable, not least because Russell had had a single nomination and it was the first and therefore only time he was ever nominated for the prize. He won it at the first go. And another oddity about it is that apparently Bertrand Russell was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize no less than 46 times but never actually won the thing. Strange how life turns out. Russell's citation for the prize said it was awarded, quote, in recognition of his varied and significant writings in which he champions humanitarian ideals and freedom of thought. Well, since Greene was a first-time nominee in 1950, the Swedish Academy considered a 3-page expert appraisal of Greene by Per Hallström, one of its members and a former actual chairman of the Nobel Prize Committee. He remarked of Greene in this appraisal that, quote, the literary critics in England revere him as an accomplished novelist, and a few even go so far as to place him in the range of the best of his generation. Hallström gave some brief biographical details about Greene, including Greene's conversion to Catholicism, and commented, quote, he believes in the kingdom of heaven as well as in the existence of hell. Hallstrom followed with a consideration of The Power and the Glory, rating it as his best book, but finding it, quote, dry and colourless. Hallstrom wrote that the book was very influenced by film, and not in a good way, in which there is no room for true storytelling. It is sufficient just to give scenes. There followed, in Hallstrom's appraisal, seven lines on the heart of the matter. It proclaims compassion as the only way to achieve humankind's and life's inner meaning, wrote Hallstrom, and three lines on Brighton Rock, including the comment, it appears that the book is a detective novel. Hallstrom didn't consider Graham Greene to be worthy of the Nobel Prize. Also from those Nobel papers of 1950, we have the written opinion of the then Nobel Committee chairman, Anders Osterling. Osterling found the heart of the matter an outstanding achievement, but thought Greene's nomination was a bit premature. A dismissal of a 46-year-old writer, which at least suggested that Greene's time might come in the future. So for 1950, it was Bertrand Russell and not Graham Greene. By 1961, the next year I want to consider, Graham Greene had added greatly to his literary portfolio, of course, and had four nominations for the Nobel Prize in that year. That was the highest we've got a record from that record for the list I read out, you saw earlier. Since 1950, Greene had published the major novels The End of the Affair, The Quiet American, Our Man in Havana, and A Burnt Out Case. And in The Burnt Out Case's case, that was first published in Sweden itself in 1960, a year before its appearance in the UK and the USA, a point I'll return to later. He also, Greene, had three very successful plays to his credit in the 1950s. These were all works to be given serious consideration by the committee and the Academy. And at 57 now, Greene was certainly no longer to be seen as a literary newcomer. He was among 66 authors considered that year, among them the American poet Robert Frost and the English novelist E.M. Forster, both in their 80s and apparently considered too old by then. And also J.R.R. Tolkien, considered second rate. John Steinbeck was also in the running, but he won it the following year in 1962. As for Greene, the Nobel papers show that he was given very serious consideration in 1961. Anders Osterling, the man who had considered Greene's nomination in 1950 a bit premature, and still a Nobel Committee chairman, now in his written opinion declared Greene to be, quote, a fully fledged candidate who should be considered for his recent work as well as his contribution as a whole. But that was not enough to win Greene the prize. That prize went in 61 to the Yugoslav author Ivo Andrić, shown here, also nominated four times that year, whose Nobel citation referred to the epic force with which he has traced themes and depicted human destinies. So we know that Graham Greene came second that year to Andrić, with the Danish author Karen Blixen third. But as always, notes relating to how the final decision on Andrić was made were not released. So we don't know why in the end it was Andrić and not Greene. So on to 1967. Greene had now been awarded the Companion of Honour in the UK and had a major new novel, The Comedians, to his credit. In that year, a total of 69 writers were nominated, including three who were to win in subsequent years, Yasunari Kawabata, Samuel Beckett, and Saul Bellow. Nobel papers from 1967 show that Graham Greene again reached the shortlist of five. along with Kawabata, Jorge Luis Borges, W.H. Auden, and the Guatemalan writer Miguel Angel Asturias. Again, the Nobel Committee chairman was Anders Osterling, and his written comments for the committee in 67 included very critical comments on Asturias, too narrowly limited in his revolutionary world, and on Borges, too exclusive or artificial in his ingenious miniature art. By now, Osterling was firmly in Green's camp, writing of him as, quote, an accomplished observer whose experience encompasses a global diversity of external environments, and above all, the mysterious aspects of the inner world, human conscience, anxiety, and nightmares. But Green's appointment was opposed by three other members of the committee, we now know, some of whom also disagreed with Osterling's dismissal of Asturias. There seems to have been something of a power struggle within the Nobel Committee. Although unanimity in the committee is rare, it was highly unusual for the chairman's recommendation essentially to be ignored. So Osterling's power, it seemed, was weakened, and it might not be unconnected that he stepped down as chairman of the committee in 1970, 3 years later. So with Green blocked in 1967, some horse trading then apparently went on. A shared prize between Asturias and Borges was proposed by the Green opposition. Auden, given a second proposal, well, if not them, what about him? But ultimately, Asturias, the man pictured here, alone was awarded the prize. His citation said that the award was, quote, for his vivid literary achievement, deep-rooted in the national traits and traditions of Indian peoples of Latin America. Well, as a background to that decision in 67, there's an interesting speculation by Kaj Schuller, the Swedish journalist who examined the 67 Nobel papers when they were released in January 2018. Green may have lost support, Schuller wrote, because the Academy slowly was orienting itself towards a more global outlook. It was, after all, the second half of the 1960s, and the climate in Western societies was more interested in everything outside Europe. There may be some evidence for Schuller's view. In the 24 years from 67 to 1991, when Green died, of course, the Nobel Prize in Literature was awarded to a total of, I make it, 9 writers from born outside Europe. And that's a marked change from the previous Europe-centric pattern of choices. So if that was a factor in the overlooking of Green from the mid-1970s, there's a certain irony there, I think. A British writer commended as, in Osterling's word, an accomplished observer whose experience encompasses a global diversity of external environments, who was being passed over in the interests of global diversity. Okay. In 1974, there was an entirely opposite decision to what I've just discussed, when the Swedish Academy awarded the Nobel Prize to 2 of its own members. Ewind Johnson, the guy on the left, was awarded it for the narrative art far seeing in lands and ages in the service of freedom. And the chap on the right, Harry Martinson, for writings that catch the dewdrop and reflect the cosmos. Interestingly, Erwin Johnson, was one of the 3 committee members who had successfully blocked the choice of Green in 1967. Of course, in 1974, we're now in new territory, because the Nobel Papers for 1974 will not be released until January 2025. And so we've no direct written evidence of what went on within the Swedish Academy to produce this result. But we do know that there was a wave of controversy and hostile reaction to that year's awards to these two gentlemen jointly. Corruption was actually alleged by one Swedish critic. Younger writers pointed out that Jonsson and Martinsson had written their best works too long ago and that neither had won any international reputation. While from within the Swedish Academy, member Arthur Lundqvist strongly opposed the prize decision and urged Jonsson and Martinsson not to accept the prize, thinking it would make them unhappy. Lundqvist later said he thought the award had brought the authors to a too early death. Whatever the rights and wrongs of that award, it might be worth pointing out that no Swedish writer has ever awarded the Literature Prize to a member of the Swedish Academy, or indeed a Swedish writer, since that controversy in 1974. And what of Graham Greene? Well, by 1974, he'd published Travels with My Aunt, A Sort of Life, and The Honorary Consul. And the rumours in literary circles in that year were that Greene, Jorge Luis Borges again, Saul Bellow, and Vladimir Nabokov were the favourites. But we have to wait until 2025 to see just how close Greene actually came to getting the prize. My last snapshot year is 1983, again one for which we have no Nobel papers, but I'd suggest it's a significant year for Graham Greene. By 1983, Greene was 79 years old, and his most recent literary achievements were The Human Factor, Dr. Fisher of Geneva, and Monsignor Quixote, I think his last masterpiece. Now, surely, was his last chance for the prize. The prize that year went instead to William Golding for his novels, which with the perspicacity of realistic narrative art and the diversity and universality of myth, illuminate the human condition in the world of today. But after the announcement of the award, some of the Academy, Swedish Academy, broke their duty of silence and commented on Golding as that year's choice. Arthur Lundqvist, who's becoming a serial offender in this respect, the man who opposed, you remember, the 1974 award, went public criticising the choice of Golding and arguing that the prize should have gone to Claude Simon, the avant-garde French philosopher and novelist, who, by the way, won the prize 2 years later. Lundqvist told journalists that Mr. Golding was decent but hardly in the Nobel Prize class. He called the judgment a coup, without explanation. There were rumours that Golding had been a compromise candidate and that Graham Greene and Jorge Luis Borges had been blocked in some way. Lars Forssell, a Swedish novelist and Academy member, acknowledged to reporters that the award to Golding would raise again the issue of the non-recognition of his compatriot, of Golding's compatriot, Graham Greene, whom many regarded as deserving the Nobel. Greene should have won it in the 1950s, Forssell told journalists. Arne Ruth, the editor-in-chief of another Stockholm newspaper, Dagens Nyheter, said that the selection meant, quote, that the Graham Greene problem had been resolved, that Mr. Greene would never now win the prize. The Academy, he predicted, would now move on to the literatures of other nations. And there's much to agree with in that assessment. In 1983, after being an almost perennial candidate for over 30 years, Graham Greene was passed over in favour of another British author in 83, who was 7 years his junior. And no other British writer was likely to win the award during Greene's lifetime, and none did. So we don't know how close Greene came in 1983, but now I think his time would not come again. So can we suggest any reasons why Graham Greene never actually got the Nobel Prize? It's perhaps worth first making the general point that the annual task of the Swedish Academy is actually an almost impossible one. Quite apart from the immense cultural and linguistic problems involved in trying to compare the very disparate output of up to 100 writers from across the world, there's the problem of precisely what the Literature Prize is, what the Literature Prize is meant to be awarded for. Is it for an individual work or a body of work, for instance? Is it meant to support and encourage promise, or is it a reward for a career of excellence? The precise terms of Alfred Nobel's will, which set up the prize, is open to interpretation. It said that the Literature Prize would go to, and of course this is translated from the original Swedish, to the person who shall have produced in the field of literature the most outstanding work of an ideal tendency. So it's possible to see it as a recognition of a single work, I guess. And although that's not the usual interpretation, there are a number of prize citations which have made specific reference to a specific work by the winner. And although the usual practice is to reward a writing career which is pretty substantial by the time of the award, the age at which the prize is given can vary very widely, from 41, the youngest winner, Rudyard Kipling in 1907, to 87, Doris Lessing in 2007. So Graham Greene was not necessarily too young to win in 1950, at the age of 46. Indeed, Albert Camus won at that age in 1957, the same decade. Nor was he too old in 1983, age 79. And one could make a case for awarding him the prize for a single work, Power and the Glory, for instance, or for what by the 1960s was certainly an already very substantial body of serious literary output. But the biggest problem with the terms of Nobel's will lies in the interpretation of that key phrase, work of an ideal tendency. What exactly does ideal mean there? Most suitable? Perfect? There was a tendency to interpret Nobel's words as meaning idealistic, in the sense of hopeful or not pessimistic. And in the first 50 years of the Nobel Prize, the Swedish Academy, I think by its own admission, often seemed to interpret the words in that way, idealistic. Hence, never giving the prize, for instance, to the pessimistic and fatalistic Thomas Hardy. There may be echoes of that interpretation in 1950, Greene's first year, when Bertrand Russell was commended for championing humanitarian ideals and freedom of thought. But beyond those general points, there's not been a shortage of suggestions as to why Greene never won the prize. I've read it suggested that Greene's novels don't translate well into Swedish, but I've no expertise in the area to know how true that might be. Professor John Carey of Oxford University wrote that it has sometimes been ascribed to the untimely anti-Semitism of his pre-war novels. And Greene's hostile biographer, Michael Sheldon, nods in agreement. It'd be interesting to see whether supposed anti-Semitism was part of any decision, but I've never seen any. Much of the discussion about Greene's position is based on rumour and speculation, often hard to pin down or prove. Jonathan Yardley, a book critic and columnist for the Washington Post, wrote an angry column in that paper in October 1982, denouncing the Academy for refusing to give the award to the writer who deserves it above all others now living, Graham Greene. Yardley referred to a whole collection of reported reasons for Greene's omission. His perverse insistence on writing from time to time what he calls entertainments. His irreverent view of Orthodox Catholicism. His departure from England and the punitive taxes it imposes on successful writers. And his contempt generally for authority, whether secular or ecclesiastical. These are the rumours Yardley had heard. But he concludes, there's another reason. Quote, there's no question that a central reason for Greene's rejection is that his politics do not coincide with those of the Swedish Academy, which waits for lefty, capital L. Greene is too bleak, too aware of life's ambiguities and compromises for the apple-cheeked, idealistic, naive Swedes. There's much there that might have a grain of truth in it, and it's interesting to read Yardley talking about the idealistic Swedes, an echo of Nobel's will, perhaps. Perhaps the seedy world of Greenland did not find favour in Stockholm, and Greene had sufficient clear-eyed optimism for the Swedish Academy. Another aspect of how Graham Greene was seen in Sweden goes back to the 1950s, when he was first being considered for the Nobel Prize. Greene made a number of trips to Stockholm in that decade, in which a serious affair developed between Greene and the actress Anita Björk. Michael Mayer, Greene's friend who lived in Stockholm, wrote in his memoir that in Sweden there was a good deal of envy of Graham for his having been Anita's lover. More, Mayer writes of what he calls an extraordinary row that blew up in Sweden in the summer of 1960 over Greene's play The Complacent Lover. There's a scene in Greene's play in which there is suddenly a fear that the central character may have gassed himself in a garage. That's the way that Anita Björk's husband, Stig Dagerman, an author and journalist, had killed himself in 1954. As Michael Mayer wrote, the rumour went round in Stockholm that Graham Greene had drawn the parallel deliberately to wound either Anita or Stig's memory or both. This is after the end of his affair with Anita Björk. Greene strongly denied any such intention, but the suggestion has been made that that controversy damaged Greene's chances of ever winning the Nobel Prize. 1960, when the row broke out, was, of course, as I mentioned, the year in which a burnt-out case was first published in Sweden. And 2 years later, as we've seen, Greene was narrowly passed over for the Nobel. But it's just worth noting on that issue that Michael Mayer himself didn't actually think that the antagonism over Anita Björk and The Complacent Lover was a factor in that 1961 decision, or indeed more generally in the decisions against Greene. Ultimately, the repeated decisions not to give the Nobel Prize to Graham Greene boils down to the people of the committee and academy who made the decisions. So we should address the elephant in the room, I think, and look in particular at Arthur Lundquist, the man usually said, for instance, by Norman Cherry, to have been the one who repeatedly blocked Greene. We've already heard about Lundquist as the Academy member who was strongly against the awarding of the prize to Eivind Jonsson and Harry Martinson in 1974 and to William Golding in 1983. and who, despite being a member of the Swedish Academy, did make his views known publicly. He was from humble origins, Lundqvist. He had only 6 years of formal education, but had an incredible record of educating himself, and he did become a very considerable writer, poet, literary critic in Sweden. He was elected as a member of the Swedish Academy at the age of 62 in 1968, and from 69 to 86 served on the smaller Nobel Committee. Well, a background to his role on that Academy Committee. When Green's play The Living Room was given its premiere in Stockholm in 1953, Lundqvist had given it a damning review. Here is yet another Catholic saying the same old thing. The most dangerous and unpleasant thing about Green's play is the way in which it attacks modern psychology. In this play, Green reveals himself as a morally dangerous writer in league with the darkest powers of present-day Western reactionism. Much later, as a member of the Nobel Committee, Ludwig was quite happy to make his antipathy to Green clear. He told journalist Peter Lennon in 1980 that, quote, 30 years ago, I was very impressed by him. I thought The Power and the Glory was a very good book. But I think his work has declined. Lundqvist also told Lennon, Green is too popular. And anyway, he doesn't need the money. Before concluding, personally, I will not vote for him. That's at a time when he was still a member of the decision-making committee. Much later, after he'd stepped down from the Academy and Green's chance had gone by then, Lundqvist told literary editor Myron Grindier that he had objected to Green over the years because he was a Catholic. Norman Sherry also quotes Lundqvist as having said that Green would win the prize over my dead body. This seems to be an important factor during a crucial period of Green's consideration for the Nobel Prize, the hugely powerful and influential Arthur Lundqvist was in the way. But we should also remember that Lundqvist, as I said, only joined the Academy in 1968. And in the 3 years where we have the Nobel papers, 50, 61, 67, the three I've considered, other factors must have been at work. Lundqvist was not on the committee. It's worth also mentioning one or two other influential writers and names on the committee. Lars Gyllensten, doctor and author, was a member of the Swedish Academy for 40 years from 1966, served on the prize committee from 1968 to 87, acting as its chairman from 1981 to 87. When the decision was announced in 1983 to award the prize to William Golding, Gyllensten was reported as being opposed to giving it to Graham Greene. He was in the Lundqvist lobby. And given that his tenure of office on the committee almost exactly matches that of Lundqvist, it's hard not to see the two as allies in blocking Greene for almost two decades. A further name to mention briefly is this man, Carl Ragnar Gieroff, a theatre director, author and translator. A member of the Swedish Academy from 1961, who sat on the Nobel Committee for 20 years from 1963 and chaired it throughout the 1970s. He's significant in that he nominated Green for the Nobel Prize in 67 and 68. So in 67, he was an ally of Anders Österling in unsuccessfully pressing the claims of Green against the opposition of three other members. But his chairmanship of the committee in the 1970s coincided with Lundqvist and Gyllensten's membership of the committee and their opposition to Green. Finally, from the Swedish Academy, we should remind ourselves about Anders Osterling. I've skipped a slide. This is Giro. This is Osterling. Sorry if I've caused confusion. Osterling was a poet, a critic, and translator, and had an extraordinary history. In 1919, at the age of 35, he was elected to the Swedish Academy, serving it until his death, a record period of 62 years. He served on the committee from 1947, chaired it from 47 to 1970. We've already traced the arc of his response to Graham Greene's writings, from a nomination in 1950 that was a bit premature, to Greene being a fully fledged candidate in 1961, to his proposal of Greene for the prize in 1967, because he was an accomplished observer whose experience, etc. By the time the journalist Peter Lennon interviewed him in 1980, the year before Osterling died, Osterling was recorded as saying, "I regret Graham Greene never got the prize. His name would have adorned our list very well." In 1981, he was already talking about Greene's chances in the past tense. Greene's opportunity apparently had gone. So the evidence is that Greene's best chance of winning the Nobel Prize seems to me to have come before 1968, when Lundqvist arrived at the Swedish Academy. If 1950 was a bit too early for him, then his best chances perhaps came in 1961, when he came second, and 1967, when the chairman's support for him was blocked by three other committee members. What made the crucial difference, we will actually never know. Perhaps some combination of the many factors that have been touched on. But I'm tempted to agree with the assessment of an article by Michael Mayer in the Daily Telegraph in December 1975. Mayer was not only a friend of Graham Greene, but a translator, biographer, journalist, and dramatist who specialised in Scandinavian literature and who lived in Sweden from 1947 until the 1970s. This is what Mayer concluded. "Over the 20 years and more that I've lived in Sweden, I've continually noted how Swedish critics, consciously or unconsciously, separate literature into two classes, good literature and entertainment literature. This, I am convinced," Mayer says, "is why Graham Greene has never been awarded the Nobel Prize. Greene, even at his most serious, is compulsively readable and is accordingly regarded by the members of the Swedish Academy with grave suspicion. How can a white writer whose novels can be finished in a couple of sittings be truly deep-minded?" It is, I think, a persuasive argument from one who knew the literary scene and academic scene in Stockholm well. And Greene had perhaps done himself no favours with the Swedish Academy by dividing his books into novels and entertainments. His writings made him that very rare breed, an author who was critically acclaimed and wrote bestsellers. As Arthur Lundqvist put it, "Greene is too popular." I sense that you sense I've finished. I've two short paragraphs. Is that okay, Richard? Okay. Just to change the focus slightly. One thing briefly to consider, and then I'll shut up. What was Graham Greene's reaction to being so persistently passed over for the prize? There's a tendency to paint him as insouciant about the matter. Michael Mayer wrote of Graham failing to receive the Nobel Prize, "Not that this bothers him, for the ridiculousness of most of the awards has devalued the prize, except in terms of money, which he does not need." And after Greene's death, his friend Father Leopoldo Duran wrote, "For many years Graham Greene was convinced that they would never give him the prize, but it was not a matter that caused him to lose any sleep." But actually the evidence is that in the early days at least, Green cared very deeply about winning the prize. Once the possibility was known to him, he would hardly have been human not to have cared. And it's worth remembering that there was at least one time in his life where the money would have come in rather handy, for in the mid-1960s, when he'd been seriously swindled by Thomas Rowe. From the late 1940s, he would have received literary gossip from Stockholm via his friend Michael Mayer and his Swedish publisher Ragnar Svanström, and his interest was kept alive for a long time, it seems. We know that in October 1950, he went to Stockholm to have dinner with the permanent secretary of the Nobel Committee, one Anders Osterling, and another member of the committee, writing afterwards to his agent in Paris, "Strictly between you and me, it was to nurse my constituency." To his brother Hugh at the same time, he identified the three leading contenders, Per Lagerkvist, the favourite, Faulkner and self. Odds on the Swede and Faulkner, but perhaps next year. In 1952, he met Per Lundqvist in Stockholm, by then the Nobel Prize winner for 51, and perhaps a useful ally in helping Green to the prize. In 1955, Green was at it again at a dinner hosted by his Swedish publisher with guests including Anders Osterling. In 1960s, as we've seen, a burnt-out case was published first in Sweden, a year before its appearance in the UK and USA. Some smelled a rat. In Britain in November, an article appeared in the Daily Mail with the heading, "Is Graham Greene's new book aimed at the Nobel Prize?" The evidence actually seems to be that Green probably didn't use the publication as a ploy, but rather gave in to pressure from Svanström, his Swedish publisher. But there's little doubt that Green continued to hope, and perhaps even on occasion expect, that one day the prize would be his. As late as 1979, Green was writing to the American poet Mary Connell, "Last year, not only my Swedish publishers, but the press in general believed that the Nobel was coming to me." But Green also became aware of the opposition and influence of Lundqvist and became, I think, sardonic and fatalistic about the whole business. He would never win the prize, and of course he never did. As Father Duran, who knew Green from 1973, wrote, "Graham Greene and I discussed the question of the Nobel Prize, particularly in the early years of our friendship. Later, it was scarcely ever mentioned." So, Graham Greene never became one of the Nobel laureates, the list of whom includes Pearl S. Buck, the 1938 winner who Greene sometimes rather scoffed at. Instead, he joined the ranks of Thomas Hardy and Anton Chekhov, Leo Tolstoy and Virginia Woolf, Joseph Conrad and Henry James, Marcel Proust and James Joyce, who also failed to impress the Swedish Academy. Thank you. And apologies for going on so very long. You've been extremely patient.
Mike, thank you so much for that. A bit of me wants to say that it was a lecture of an ideal quality there, but it's actually better than that. It's a wonderful combination of close detective work and insight, and very enlightening. I'm wondering if some folks would like to ask any questions of Mike on the subject.
Surely not.
Okay, everybody. It's brilliant to comment, actually, Mike.
Because of that is the strength of Graham Greene as a writer to be nominated for that period of time, 33 years from the first nomination to the last nomination in 1983.
Just to be absolutely clear, David, we don't know that he was nominated through to 83. We only have the nomination records of 72.
Fair
I'm
comment.
I'm guessing that he continued to be nominated, and the rumours were that he was.
Let's say that your guess is a very good one, Mike.
Yeah.
So that's 33 years, assuming to 1983, that Graham Greene was seen as a world-class author. And I should suggest, and maybe I'm wrong, that many of the other people who have won the award have never had that expansion of time to be nominated on before they won it. So I think, though Graham Greene may have privately, and you've mentioned also, been disappointed, I think there's also a strength there to show that he was a world well thought of author. And I think they should be probably asking themselves how they couldn't have nominated him when there's a possible period of 33 years where it was brought to the attention of the committee.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say is I deliberately did not say at any point, I hope I didn't say, Graham Greene should have won the prize. It would be presumptuous in the extreme for me to make that judgment. I've never read a word of Evil Andrich. I've never read a word of Astorius, let alone Perlesk Book. I know he wasn't a competitor with Perlesk Book. So I've no idea whether they ever made the wrong decision. That would be a qualitative decision I'm not in a position to make. I just know that lots and lots of people who liked Greene's writing, who thought he was worthy of winning the prize and said so year after year, and there, whether or not he won the prize, there's something to be explained there over such a long period. That's all I would claim. There's something serious to be explained there. And I think you're right. There's a question mark there.
I'll just ask one, Mike. Do you think the crucial mistake Greene made in the 70s was, instead of writing The Honorary Consul and The Human Factors, he should have been cutting some albums with Sinatra? Because then he could have done a Bob Dylan.
I couldn't possibly comment on such a suggestion, Ian.
And so I think that's a wonderful moment for us to step outside and get a cup of coffee. Thank you so much, Mike. It's a wonderful, wonderful presentation.
Thank you for being so patient.